Chief, you've got the floor.
Thank you.
Commission Chair, members of the Commission, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. It's been a while since we've had an enforcement update. New members on the Commission, as well as our new director. Thought it'd be a good time to go over some of the developments and also answer some of your questions that you've sent to us. The first topic that we're going to cover is officer complaints, internal investigations. I'm going to take these in segments. My deputy chief to the right of me is going to cover a portion of this as well. But at the end of each segment, we'll go ahead and take an opportunity to take a pause so you can ask some questions because the subject matters are slightly different from each other. So officer complaints, employee complaints are done under our regulation 2.80. The regulation incorporates collective bargaining agreement language as well as our agency policy. And it also is governed by the Washington Administrative Codes for those that are not in classified positions. And so the regulation covers subject matters such as sexual harassment, accountability, discipline, applicable collective bargaining agreements are part of that as well. Alleged complaints come in through a number of vectors, one of which is through the internet where we have a complaint and accommodation page. The citizens are also able to contact our regional offices and get directly to our first line supervisors as well as our captains, depending upon the level of the offense and at what level the offender might be within our organization. So the determination of who receives that is based on the first level supervisor of the individual. Allegations such as abuse of power, abuse of authority, excessive use of force, discrimination, harassment, which we don't have many of those at all, those would be elevated to the deputy chief level. Lesser offenses such as tardiness, vehicle collisions, those are generally handled at the first line supervisor level, depending on who the offender is again. Supervisors inquire into the complaint. They take statements from those who are witnesses. They also may be required to take some evidence from the field when they're conducting these investigations. But again, that first line supervisor is the one that generally is responsible for collecting the information at the investigative level. Complaints that appear that cannot be handled through corrective action such as a memo of concern or a letter of direction are forwarded up through the chain of command. Lesser offenses would be considered a vehicle collision that has been investigated, and those are handled, again, at that officer complaint level of a memo of concern or a letter of direction. Those lesser offenses are put inside the supervisor file. They stay there for 1 year. They can be addressed through the evaluation process, and that continues on maybe a document that you can refer back into the future, but those that are in the supervisory file are removed after 1 year. Those that rise to a higher level that possibly could have a monetary impact to the employee are sent to the deputy chief for review, and it's at that stage where they take into consideration whether or not there's a possibility of suspension, a possibility of dismissal, or a possibility of reduction in pay. if those factors are present, we go through a pre-disciplinary hearing process, and that's where the individual is informed that they will be having a hearing type setting before me, the appointing authority, and they are asked to present any type of mitigating circumstances that they want me to consider before meeting out the discipline. Collective bargaining agreements in the CBA, they have just cause requirements, forms of discipline, investigative process, timelines. That's very important to our staff that are in those collective bargaining units. They want to make sure that the investigation is done in a timely manner, and at 60 days they can make a request through the proper channels to get an update on where they are and where we are in the investigation, and we make a report back to the affected party. The collective bargaining agreement also talks about the grievance process. If there is a discipline form that's been handed out and there is disagreement as to the level or if just cause was followed, they have a grievance process that goes at different levels depending on which level the discipline was dealt out. There's the next step up, which ultimately ends up at the director level or further. I'm going to turn the mic over to Mike, and he's going to cover some of our activity. But before he begins, is there any questions about the investigative process for internal complaints?
Commissioner Winker?
I think one of the pieces that I'm interested in is what happens if there's allegations being made at higher level, executive management level, personnel. How are those allegations handled? And does the director have a role?
Yes, thank you for the question. At the administrative level, you're always going up the next level in order to address any type of allegations. Our HR department also assists in that process. They're part of the director's a tool in their tool bag in order to address those issues. And because it happens at that command level, it may require the use of HR. And they have other tools available to them within the HR division as well, which is outside investigators that give a third-party opinion of the allegations and put out a report that can be decided on at the director level.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Director, members of the commission, hi, I'm Mike Sensi. This slide just represents the scope of responsibility that we have, the authorizing environment, if you will. We enforce a number of titles. We have the ability as general authority police to make arrests for all crimes, state of Washington crimes. We also have two federal commissions as well, and the ability to pursue federal violations. Some of our state titles specifically list the agency as a primary enforcer outside of Title 77. One example would be Title 6930. It's a Department of Health chapter, and it relates to sanitary control of shellfish. And this agency is identified as the primary enforcer of that agency's criminal-related laws. You'll also find Fish and Wildlife, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, or the enforcement program listed in the forest products statutes and off-road vehicle statutes.
Go ahead.
So the question, this kind of dovetails in with it. The question came up about what about citation funds, the penalties, the fines that are collected under our activity. So RCW 3.6.020 deals with fees, fines, and penalties. And you can see that 32% of the fines that are collected at the county district court level are collected and they are remitted from the county treasurer to the state treasurer. Those funds go in directly to the state general fund. The remaining amount that is collected through those fines and fees are held at the county level. The whole PILT process, I know you all are well aware of that. That's a different kettle of fish completely. But you can see that the funding that or the fees and penalties, those funds do not come directly to Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife or the enforcement program. They are a general fund item. And maybe indirectly you could see where some of that funding stream could come from.
Mr. Chair, the commission asked for us to discuss where we spend our time, specifically as it relates to general authority type activities compared to natural resource protection. And, you know, as we were preparing for this overview on where we invest our efforts, I spent a fair amount of time with our records management system, and we're in better shape today than we were 5 years ago, definitely 10 years ago, or when I started 24 years ago. But our system is far from perfect. The data we collect and the way we collect it, it doesn't tell the story very well. The challenge is more on the input side, where we invest our hours. Though without context, even the output, the kinds of charges or enforcement actions that are generated from a contact, that may not be reflective of reality. And I'll try to build some context here. Most of our general authority time and enforcement actions have a natural resource nexus. So the 5% that you see, the 3% that you see under general law enforcement in the pie slice here, again, really doesn't, it isn't a pure number. So, for instance, someone found violating a hunting law may also be a convicted felon. They may not be allowed to possess the firearm that they used. That individual may have a warrant for their arrest. They may have drugs on their person or some other general authority-related issue. And we're going to address that. When activities blend, the officer is often forced to find a single category under our current design to plug that hour into. So you don't get the breadth of, you know, all the activities that hour covered. Today, in King County, go ahead and go to the next slide, sir. In King County, the owner of GNR Shellfish is scheduled to be sentenced to prison for his role in an estimated theft of about $2 million in shellfish total. And he pled guilty to 17 counts of theft and multiple counts, I think within that also counts of reckless endangerment. And those are all authority, general authority crimes is reflected in our statistics in this number here. And the nexus to the mission is really hidden. I mean, here's what it looks like a little more daylighted. We're identified as statute as the primary enforcer of DOH's sanitary shellfish laws. So as this individual laundered his product through the marketplace, he falsified shellfish health certification tags in order to hide origin of the product. That jeopardized public safety. That was in direct violation of DOH laws, and it prevented health officials from tracing product back if there were an outbreak. So there's a nexus that you don't see under a charge of theft or reckless endangerment. This individual also upset the balance for tribal and non-tribal resource sharing. We have some obligations there under U.S. v. Washington and other associated court cases. The state has an obligation to provide shellfish harvest opportunities on public tide lands in Hood Canal and Puget Sound. And so the agreement that we have with the tribes is that we won't have any non-Indian commercial harvest. Those remote areas, remote from public access, those will be set aside for tribal harvest, whereas areas where the public will have access are set aside for recreational interests, and the tribes have agreed not to harvest there. So this fellow stole most of his product from the remote areas, therefore affecting, you know, the fair sharing agreement that we had with the tribe, which could have some consequences down the road as we try to make up for that, if we need to make up for that. So that's pretty blurred under the charge of theft. And then, of course, there's, you know, the impact to, you know, shellfish bed sustainability on top of all that. So some of our general authority is done on our way to patrol areas. So if a deputy needs backup, we're going to be there because we rely on that individual to back us up. If there's a serious accident, I think the public expects us to stop and address that public safety piece. But it's generally seamless because we're usually in the area. We're going to or from patrol grounds when we encounter these things. This general authority piece also includes it also includes search and rescue. The traffic sliver that you see there, that's not our guys in the I-5 corridor pulling over speeders. If somebody goes by an officer at 90, that's a public safety issue. That individual's going to get stopped. If they're potentially intoxicated, I think the public expects us to stop that person. Where a lot of our traffic violations are encountered are on our own lands. There's a lot of blend here. There's some off-road vehicle pieces associated with this as well. So, again, the 10% represented there, what all that 10% represents may not be, isn't well illustrated. But if you take Discover Pass enforcement, which is a hard connect, you know, has a hard connection with our mission, and you add that to the natural resource piece, and you add boating safety and registration, again, where we're specifically identified to enforce laws. You know, that natural resource block becomes even bigger. I'm not saying that once in a while we don't. General authority finds us. We don't necessarily go looking for it. Just last week, and this is relatively common, we had an officer headed home. He was cruising through his neighborhood, and he saw a guy casing a house. This community has been hit hard by burglaries. In fact, there are signs in the windows of several residences that say, "There's nothing else to steal. Don't bother." He wound up in a foot pursuit with this individual, took him into custody, and hauled him off to jail. Where we can transfer something to another agency, we will, but we try not to make a habit of it. Other law enforcement agencies believe that if we catch it, we should clean it, and that's the way we generally do business. If it's a DUI, Trooper gets credit for that. If I can, you know, get through the initial probable cause and the stop and have him come in and do the field sobriety tests and take that individual to the breathalyzer and process from there, I will do that. And that trooper will appreciate the free case, if you will. Helps with his statistics, and it gets us back on the road. But these other law enforcement agencies, when we interact, better understand what our mission is. They look for the kinds of things that we're interested in. The bottom line is the real bad guys, the real hardcore poachers, they're into everything. The local burglar is also stealing natural resources. The drug dealer is also stealing natural resources. We have many examples of some of our most prolific poachers. Commissioner Wecker knows of several in the county that she lives in where the individuals are they're heavy into drugs. They burglarize local residences. And when they're not doing that, they're poaching. And so the sheriff's office really relies on a partnership with us in order to put those guys completely out of business. And you may be surprised by this, but we have many examples of where judges have just laid the deadwood to a poacher, and that individual has gone to jail or prison in some cases, while at the same time the local jurisdiction wasn't able to get any time for a burglary. So a lot of interaction, but we're very careful about making sure that our staff is focused. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions related to either one of those pie charts or concerns. I will add, that one of the examples that I heard floating around out there as mission drift related to a metal theft case, and it was in Eastern Washington. It's an example being passed around here recently. And in that case, our officers knew the farmers and the landowners who had granted the public access to large tracts of property, and were in a position to deal with an organized group of individuals that were stealing sprinkler heads and metal parts that, you know, they leave out in their fields. It was at a great cost to these farmers who were wondering whether they just needed to shut down property to all access, you know, in order to protect that property. And those officers and Captain Anderson out of Ephrata convinced those farmers that you're better off having legitimate legal activities, participation out here, because folks are going to be another set of eyes for you, help police your property, maintain order. And should that have been a local sheriff's office investigation? Yeah, and it's not like they weren't excluded. There was a great deal of collaboration between our officers who actually knew the players and the sheriff's office. And it was a big case. I mean, there were tens of thousands of dollars stolen from these farmers that provide a benefit to our public to access their properties to hunt and fish.
Mr. Wicker?
Thanks. I know we're not done here, but this is so important. This issue has come up every year I've been on the commission, I think, and in the earlier years, there, I think, was a higher sense of discomfort. I don't remember when general authority was provided to the department, but it's just come up regularly. And I'm aware, too, that the enforcement program has instituted new mechanisms, new software in recent years to make accounting of the officer's time more available? Is that working out well? Is that the CODI system? Is that the way you account for the way officer time is?
So our time accounting has improved, but Deputy Chief Sensi mentioned how officers have a tendency to lump activity. And you can imagine being out there working hard days in the field, and now it's time to account for your entire day. And sometimes that happens in the middle of elk season, commercial fishing season, and this is one more thing to do. And so some of those shortcuts end up being garbage in, garbage out data. We're pretty good in that respect. I don't think that occurs too often. But records management systems definitely allow you to get a full grasp of what your people are doing. And you know, the difference between these two pie charts is one is time. The other one is enforcement activity. What type of citations are being handed out? What kind of written warnings are being delivered? So in that aspect, I think one of the bigger, more difficult stories to tell is time in the field. And you can imagine that officer presence adds up to a lot more than warm water fish or lands patrols. An officer traveling through a geographical area may very well be driving by a lake that there's fishermen on, but right at the back of that lake is a location where poaching could happen on the wildlife side as well. So it becomes very difficult to be able to capture that. We're one of those programs that deal with all houses, which are your habitat, doing HPA enforcement. It's about marine environment as well as inland fisheries. And then we also deal with all the wildlife aspects. And there are some people, when you mention habitat, they think that it's just about the stream that's running through a geographical location. It's not. It's also about the habitat, vegetation that's stripped off by ORV use, knocking down gates, vehicles being behind in locations where sensitive habitat is for our wildlife and for our fish. So being able to get a full grasp of what an officer does every single day, that is an absolute challenge. We are trying right now with some of our very technological officers that are out there that are very tech savvy. They've started a project. Sergeant Wickersham out, down in on the Columbia River, and several other folks that have that skill. They are looking at geographic documentation of what an officer activity could be, and it could be based off of logic that if you're driving through a geographical location in a certain time of the year, this is the type of activity that that officer will be enforcing and being a presence on. So those are some of the things that we're trying to work at to tell the full story of what the day in the life of a fish and wildlife officer is, or conversely, what it looks like if you didn't have one. And that story is very important too when we get to the next section talking about staffing.
Mr. Chair, I add to what the Chief said, just to really paint the picture. I mean, we've been talking about this for years. You go out on Puget Sound and you contact a vessel. You got to plug that hour in somewhere. Was it boating safety? Yeah, you're going to ask for life jackets. I mean, if the individual's intoxicated, you're going to take action. If the vessel's not registered, you're going to warn them or remind them or cite, depending on the circumstances. If the vessel's going down, you're going to respond and you're going to hopefully save a life. In fact, by the way, we had our Swiftwater rescue team deploy this morning, a.m., on the Duckabush River. Extreme flooding had put a community in danger. They saved three individuals from a trapped truck that was stuck in the current and people couldn't get out, and removed five individuals from a home where they were trapped. Where do I put that? I guess where I was going was, you contact that vessel, you've got all the vessel safety issues facing you. Salmon season may be open, crab season may be closed, shrimp may be closed. All those species, multiple species are there being protected in one fashion or another. I've got to pick a box. And so what the chief's suggesting is location-based reporting, where you have you get credit for your primary presence, but also your secondary presence. Because we all know that if you're in the woods in August, you're protecting big game. You're not just because the elk or deer season isn't open doesn't mean that there's not a need to protect that wildlife resource. And I just wanted to mention that there's really no significant difference between limited authority and general authority. I had limited authority when I hired in 19, when I was honored to get the job with the state as an enforcement officer. I could arrest for every crime that I encountered while I was in my jurisdiction, which was statewide. So general authority didn't really add much, didn't change the landscape much. Our accountability in the program has. The days are long gone where you write an individual a ticket for a loaded firearm in a motor vehicle during elk season, and that's all you do. If that person's a convicted felon, or they're wanted for something, and they take that firearm and they do something with it, we're in trouble as an agency. There's a great deal of liability for all of us. If the person sitting next to them is a protected individual by order, and a domestic violence breaks out at camp later, and there's some record of having made a contact with those folks, we're in trouble. So there's just... There's doing the job right, but that doesn't mean that we're drifted off our mission.
Okay, no other questions on that portion. We'll go to staffing. So we've had nearly two decades of decreased staffing, and there's a number of reasons for that, right? The cost of doing business has gone up. State budgets don't necessarily adjust for the inflationary clause that occurs. We wrap up a whole lot more training involved with our officers. The equipment is better, and that was actually kind of a stopgap in order to really bridge the gap that we had with officer presence in the field and making their time more efficient while they are there. So we invested in a lot of technology to get where we are today and be able to meet the demands that we currently have. In 1994, and you remember that is back when merger took effect, there was officer staffing levels had decreased by 23% from that year. Meanwhile, the state population increased by 43.5%. The reduction in force is reflected in once we had 17 detectives across the state, now we're down to 7. Officers provide police presence over millions of acres, and both on WDFW and those lands where our hunters and fishers are on DNR lands, and also private lands. So there's a lot to cover. In 1994, we had 165 commissioned police officer positions. The 165 number are just those that were officers and first-line supervisors, and our first-line supervisors, as you know, are sergeants. Population back in 1994 was 4.8 million. Today, we're at 6.9 million, almost 7 million people in the state of Washington. And in 2014, we have 123 officers, and you can see that crossing of the the grid where you have a reduction in force, but you also have an increased population. Some of the members of the commission have heard about the 2008 IACP study. At that time, we had a baseline of 137 sworn, and that figure encompasses all of our officers from the least senior up to the chief level. The study recommended that we double and then some up to 262 with our sworn officers. And they also recognized that as you increase numbers, you also have to increase your infrastructure in order to support that staff. And that means that there's more cases being made, there's more trucks to be purchased, and there's budget to be managed. So currently, our administrative staff is about 21%. If you take it look at police agencies across the nation, that their administrative staff is roughly around 28 to 30%. And that covers everything from property and evidence up to just your command staff as well. This is a kind of a representative map of what we looked like as far as our deployment in 1993. You can see along the I-5 corridor like we are today. That's where the vast majority of our officers were stationed because of the population of people and the rich marine resources that border the Puget Sound and our coastal access through the strait. It looks like a pretty good distribution where you have eastern Washington with the highest population and a sparse population on the east side of the state. But flash forward to 2014, these dots in orange will represent those officers that have been cut over the years. And again, that is through inflationary clauses or inflation and additional costs. And no increased budget, general fund, state reductions, the list goes on. So you lose those officers over time. What's devastating about having a reduction in force is that then you have to figure out when those officers come off the map, how do you engineer your deployment in order to meet those gaps that are not only the activity that's occurring in the field, but it's the distance, the geography that's involved in responding to problem areas, calls for service, dangerous wildlife, and that becomes a big issue for us. And so you may have to engineer over time to fill in those gaps, 5 and 10 year time spans, just because you have to wait on attrition to occur to redeploy those officers in places where you have the holes. That's kind of what we have on our staffing. I know that the commission knows that we've been on a steady decline. It seems like when you go up on the hill and ask for additional money, it seems like you get it, but you take two steps forward and sometimes you take two steps back. Difficult area to navigate, but as you know, that we're vigilant in that. We're always looking for additional opportunities to get our numbers up and be able to address the huge demand that our officers have every single day in protecting the state's natural resources. So be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Commissioner Wecker.
It's not usual protocol, but I have a question for our new director, Director Unsworth. What's it like in Idaho? Can you give us a sense of whether there's adequate staffing? Do you experience the same declines in enforcement staffing?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, it's quite a bit different. Idaho has 100 officers, quite a bit bigger state geographically, but you know, less than 2 million total population. So, you know, it's different. Could there be more? Absolutely. But they seem to do a pretty adequate job. But it makes a huge difference having that much fewer people, because, you know, most of the work is you're interacting with people. It's you're not doing other things. So I'd have to look at the detail of the budget, but
okay.
I don't know if that's much different.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Chief.
Thank
Deputy.
You,
we are going to take a